Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 457th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice board at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. And I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta. And today, we are going to be talking about sore toes and perhaps other joints as well. And to do that, we've brought Joey, a peer member, into the studio to chat with us. Joey, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Mike. Yeah, my name is Joey Tan, and I'm a pharmacist. So I do evidence review as part of the peer team, but also as part of the College of Family Physicians of Canada. So I work on a lot of systematic reviews, evidence summaries, and everything related to evidence.
And the question that we're going to talk about today is, it's an age-old question. It's a it's been around since I started practice, which was back in the early 1300s. And but it's about gout. And I don't, we haven't talked about gout for a long, long time, I don't think, Mike.
No, we haven't talked about gout for a while, and I'm glad you referenced. Now, when did you say you started practice and you learned from Hippocrates? Who was it again?
Yeah, it was it was Hippocrates, it was Socrates, it was all of them.
Okay. They probably lined up to have you as a student.
Oh, absolutely. Well, no, I taught them.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice. So, but you didn't want your name in the books.
No, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Keep it on the down low. Yeah, yeah. You didn't want the fame.
Yeah. Okay. So what I can tell you is that the rest of the podcast will actually be true.
So Joey, this is an age old question, though. James is right, and it's a bigger question than just gout and uric acid. The idea of hitting targets and that kind of thing, and the challenges that patients and care providers have in that. But what was really the key question you were asking in regards to gout and targets?
Even step back from the tool, this all stemmed from me when I was working in community practice, and I saw someone come in with, they're on about 800 to 1,000 milligrams of allopurinol, and I knew this, whoever prescribed this was just trying to hit targets. And I kind of led to the question on the tool and, with gout prevention, should you be targeting these uric acid levels, as we've probably been taught in school and you've kind of heard throughout practice and in some guidelines?
No, for sure. And right. Yeah, like I said, it's for a long, long time, it's always been, you should reach a certain target of uric acid levels for years, we only had one drug, really, allopurinol. Well, not, there was another one, but the main one that we used was allopurinol to try to get to these target uric acid levels. And these levels were written in stone, pretty much, just like all other target levels are. And so I think the question really is, what's the evidence for it?
Yeah, exactly. So on kind of the review we did, we found one RCT that actually answered this question. And I was quite surprised, because this is something we've heard time and time again. There's a specific number you target, and we'll get into that. And, you have to hit this target and you'll prevent all gout kind of idea. That's, mm-hmm. that's what I was instilled at within school. And really, realistically, it was one randomized controlled trial that answered this question of levels versus just keeping them on a stable dose of allopurinol. And this study came out only a few years ago. So it's fairly newer evidence as well. And what this randomized control trial looked at was, it was about 180 patients. And all these patients were on allopurinol. Their dose of allopurinol was between 200 to 300. These patients were, they had consistently elevated urate levels. And they had more than three gout flares in the past year. So these are patients you'd think, okay, should I bump up the allopurinol and, try to really lower the dose and try to lower those numbers of flares. So a good population to look at this question from. And they randomized them to targeting a serum urate of less than 360 millimoles per liter, or the other arm of just continuing their current dose of allopurinol, and they followed them for 12 months.
And sorry, Joey, that was 360 micromoles, right? Of
micromoles.
Yeah, of uric acid. Okay, and then so they randomized them, and what was the magic doses that they were on? Because James, I know, will be very concerned about the doses.
I'm all over the dose. it's all about the dose.
All about the dose. They start off with a mean of 270 milligrams per day, but then by the end of the trial, the intervention arm ended up getting about 400 milligrams per day of allopurinol, versus the control. They stayed relatively the same, about 290 or just round up to 300. So it wasn't that much of a difference in terms of the dosage, but it was definitely higher. And there was definitely that idea of targeting that specific urate level. And the more surprising thing was, you know, there's this that age-old idea of there's this level you target, and once you hit it, there's going to be a lot lower gout flares. But this trial actually found there was no statistical difference between targeting that target or just continuing on their regular dose. The one specific outcome we highlighted was that they have more than one gout flare. You know, it stems from that idea, you know, let's bump it up and, you know, we should really reduce those gout flares. But there's no difference between gout flares between the two groups. And more often than not, even though the study did show the intervention group reach target, about 70% of them reached that target versus 32% in the other arm, these numbers were still true. So regardless of that level they hit, gout flares didn't change too much.
So Joey, we'll just tell the audience that it seems that, so for to get one or more gout flare that occurred, and this was over 12 months, 54% of those in the intervention group got that versus 59% of those in the control. So even if that difference was real over the year, that would be at most kind of 5%. But as you mentioned, there was no, these numbers are too small to tease out that difference. So there was no statistical difference between them. And then there was other outcomes that they looked at as well. What did they find there?
Yeah, so we looked at other things such as, you know, tophi resolution, you know, did the patient's function improve or their functional status and pain, because that's also patient important. And they didn't find any difference between any of those outcomes either between the two groups. So really, like, I thought it was pretty surprising that there wasn't a lot of talk about this study, because it really kind of debunked that whole idea of targeting levels. But from what I could find, no one really talked about this study, and it seemed to get buried under a lot of in guidelines you looked at and such. Adverse events as well. So there wasn't actually any differences between serious adverse events, rashes, or GI complaints between the two arms. So there wasn't necessarily an adverse event that they found stood out from these higher doses.
So Joey, you were mentioning that people don't seem to, if they're believers in hitting targets, they don't seem to mention or discuss much this randomized control trial. So the reciprocal question on you, how many RCTs did you find that proved hitting targets were good? And then you didn't talk about them. How many was that?
None.
Yeah.
None you're willing to admit.
Yeah. And here's the interesting thing, because this, I mean, these sort of target levels that have been around for decades, Mike, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they're gospel.
Yeah. And so here's what's really interesting. This is the RCT that really has deep, and it's not a perfect RCT by any stretch of the imagination, but it was published in 2017. And so some of you guys must be wondering, well, how on earth would you have a written in stone target serum urate uric acid level for so long? And the answer is because, at least in my experience, any of these targets are not based almost literally on any decent evidence. They're not even based a lot of times on evidence. I don't know if you guys can remember way back, we used to do aminoglycoside levels. And aminoglycosides went to once a day. We used to, if you are going to use them, they're not used much anymore, but if you are, you use them once a day. And they published a therapeutic range for it. And there was not only was there not an RCT, there was not any publications showing any. It was literally a number made up.
So these are drafted almost, they're frequently drafted off of observational studies where they associate increasing urate levels with increasing flares and existing gout. And so then they'll kind of, the trouble with these is, as you and I've talked about a lot, James, is that they're, it's not a sharp inflection point that occurs at 360, right? It's a slow gradual increase. And we kind of often draw these lines where we say, okay, here's where we're going to draw a line to avoid gout. But that, if it's based on evidence, it's almost always based on observational evidence of a arbitrarily selected cut point.
Yeah, but if you put it in a guideline, it does become very black and white.
Oh, it's true.
You know, that's the problem with writing it in as a number. You know, what they really should say is this is the number, but we're kind of just kidding.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the way you write guidelines. You're not an author on any of ours, are you?
Well, apparently not. But it should say why we are saying this and so on. But Joey, there was a systematic review that did look at other evidence around sort of the relationship between getting serum urate levels to a certain level.
Yeah, yeah. So there was one systematic review that looked at all the RCTs that looked at urate lowering therapies. So that included allopurinol, but also febuxostat. And they tried to find, is there a relationship in these RCTs with, you know, achieving this level? Because oftentimes in these RCTs, the primary outcome is, you know, how many patients achieved a serum urate of less than 360. And whether there's a relationship between that and that risk of a gout flare. And they couldn't find any relationship in the systematic review. And again, it was published. It was actually published by the same author of the RCT. And oftentimes, again, this one, again, not many people talked about it. And I don't know if there's history with this author, and maybe she's trying to get out a message and no one gave her credit, but oftentimes I think we just think that gout, you know, if you're getting recurrent gout, allopurinol is the one thing you can do, and they're overlooking all the other things you could do to, you know, prevent that reoccurrence of gout. And for some reason, allopurinol gets kind of gets the credit for reducing gout reoccurrences, and we put a lot more less emphasis on, you know, diets, other types of non-farm pharmacological things. And because of that, we just say, okay, allopurinol's the golden child per se, you know, it must be doing something, and it must be doing it at a certain level. Yeah. And we just kind of throw all the other things out the window. And, you know, after the systematic review found no relationship between the two, other cohorts as well that get highlighted do show an association, but as you guys have talked about in past podcasts, you know, there's a lot of biases and flaws with just using cohort data.
Yeah, and it's not unusual for guidelines to ignore evidence that goes against what they're saying, because Mike, as you know, and Joey, you guys, they don't really do a systematic review most of the time of the evidence. You know,
yeah, and they wouldn't publish it alongside their guideline, right?
Like, yeah,
you wouldn't. Hire a group that would do a real systematic review and publish this evidence alongside of your guideline if you were going to stick to a treat to target thing. That would make you uncomfortable, I would guess.
Yeah, no kidding. Because I'm just picking on aminoglycosides, because that was sort of my first foray into evidence years and years ago. And we wrote an article, you know, in a major infectious disease journal about there's no therapeutic range for aminoglycosides based on the evidence. And I just remember looking at who cited it. Half the time it was used to reference the number for what we use as a therapeutic range.
Yeah, to argue the point that is
Yeah.
Exactly the opposite of the point you were making.
And so that's, and you know, it was the reason for the heavy alcohol drinking early in my career. But it's such a, I cannot emphasize how strongly the message is that just because there are studies showing that something doesn't work, it does not necessarily get the play. It's a very, there's a lot of strategy, if you will, around how you write guidelines and so on. And it's why we, when we write our guidelines, we preface it by always doing a systematic review ahead of time. But we are a bit of an unusual group because that is not a consistent finding, certainly with things like diabetes and other things. And so, yeah, so, I mean, so pretty much that's the evidence that we have for uric acid lowering therapies. Now, the tool did come up with a little bit of stuff on the issue of febuxostat, which is the sort of the new allopurinol.
Yeah. So there was a previous tool we kind of highlighted febuxostat. And, you know, when febuxostat came out, it was supposed to be this better version of allopurinol. Mm-hmm. It's going to lower levels better, you know, prevent more gout and cause less side effects. But what ended up happening was there was actually more gout flares with febuxostat when you compared it to allopurinol. In a recent study, and also they found more cardiovascular death with febuxostat versus allopurinol, and it even increased all-cause mortality.
Yeah, those were a little over 1% absolute increases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
For cardiovascular death and all-cause mortality. But it does lower allopurinol more effective. It does lower serum uric acid levels more effectively.
Now, Joey, correct me if I'm wrong. This data has to be incorrect because febuxostat's more expensive and newer.
Yeah, so, I know.
And have you double-checked this information? Because it can't be inferior.
It can't possibly be true.
Yeah.
I don't know. I remember I have some patients. They're like, are you sure it's not going to work better? It's not covered by my insurance. It's more expensive, so it must work better.
I've actually had patients come in who were told by someone or saw on an advertisement or something requesting this over allopurinol, and me trying to explain to them, I wouldn't do that if I were you.
I mean, the only indication would be intolerance to allopurinol.
Yeah, complete intolerance. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is. You know, a lot of people do get some, you know, sort of, I guess, sort of allergic, but certainly skin reactions to allopurinol. And if you had that, it's nice to have an option. And the evidence does show that febuxostat is more effective at lowering uric acid, but it doesn't reduce the proportion of gout flares.
But isn't that fascinating? The very thing that we're basing these targets on, it does a better job at, but it doesn't actually do a better job at outcomes that actually matter.
Yeah.
Right. Like gout flares and death. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's more important than a surrogate marker.
Yeah.
It's insane to say that it needs to be said, but it's true.
But you know what? Wait, yeah. Don't bite the, what is it? What's that expression? Don't bite the hand that feeds you. That's the reason we have done 457 podcasts. Please, everyone out there, those of you who are writing guidelines right now, and please continue to write them the way you are.
So we'll have another 400 episodes.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure everyone at home is just so excited about that prospect. Hopefully none of them are in tall buildings or anything.
So anything else you guys want to add to this?
Go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to talk about I think a lot of listeners are going to kind of think of a recent guideline that just came out, the American College of Rheumatology. They just released the guideline on gout, and they have a very specific section on, you know, treatment to treat to target, and they actually still recommend a treat to target approach. And, you know, and it'd be fair if this is, you know, based on opinions or expert opinion or whatnot, but they actually quoted evidence to back up this claim. And, you know, at that point, I was kind of thinking, like, you know, was there something I missed? Was there like a study we didn't look at? And what's interesting is when you go to look at what helped back that claim up, they actually quoted RCTs that looked at having kind of a nurse-led gout kind of prevention program versus usual care. And they kind of found that this nurse-led program led to more people reaching targets and less gout flares. And that whole stream of things is kind of what supported their recommendation. And the two other studies were very similar, except it was pharmacists instead of nurses. And it just kind of goes to show that, you know, they didn't seem like they really read in detail what the interventions were. They just really jumped to those conclusions and then just use those conclusions to support their recommendation, which is quite surprising for something, you know, such a large organization.
Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt if you task nurses, pharmacists, or whatever to get people to targets, they will get them to targets more often.
Yeah, and I think Joey's also indicating that more happened in the intervention arm than just trying to hit a target.
Yeah.
A lot more happened, mm-hmm. probably counseling around all the lifestyle stuff. There was probably other features as well, right? And so they probably got better care in sorting out what is gout and what isn't gout, all sorts of things. So these interventions, you can't, that's the trouble. We've talked about this again in lots of podcasts, but a good example is the chiropractic care ones, Joey, and you know, because you've looked at this data too. Mm-hmm. In the arm with chiropractic care is things like activity, naprosyn, you name it, versus a pamphlet. And so which actually worked there? It's very hard to tell what the active intervention was. When you do a bunch of things in the treatment arm, you can't then later go back and say, oh, it was the getting to target that really mattered. No, you can't actually tease that out later. It has to be part of the original plan to just look at getting to target as the randomized control trial that you showed us did.
Yeah. No, great stuff. Anything else you want to add, Mike, the PIPE course at all?
Yep. So the PIPE course is coming up. It will be paused for effect. Well, I actually looked it up on the October 23rd.
Yeah.
There is going to be a small in-person. So we're going to use a huge room and there'll be 25 people allowed to come as well.
Yeah.
In person if they want. So they'll be heavily dispersed among the rooms. So it'll be like one person per large table. But it will allow people to actually come just because we think it will be kind of fun to have a bit of an audience.
Mm-hmm.
But the vast majority will be virtual, and that is coming down the pipe soon.
Yeah, and I think by the time this podcast is posted, the entire schedule will be out.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So go to the website, which is, anyone remember?
Oh, so the ACFP site will have it. They can also just Google PIPE, or they can go to the peer group, or even, crazy as this sounds, the BS Medicine site.
Yeah, and type and PIPE is spelled PEIP in the language we use.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Practical Evidence for Informed Practice.
Yeah, yeah. So anything else, Joey? You're good?
No, that's everything for me.
Great. Well, I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks, as always, for listening.
Talk to you later.
Awesome. Thanks.